This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents This Messy, Magnificent Life, A Field Guide by Janine Roth. Read by the author. Prologue. Dropping the Me Project. From the beginning, I was always more anxious than the average bear. I was told at various times that I was too sensitive, too emotional, too female, too big, too curious, too demanding, too intense. The adults somehow forgot to mention that I was also sassy, silly, and keen-eyed. Regrettably, gaining and losing the same 15 pounds every few weeks did not improve my self-worth. So at age 24, I started looking for a way to handle the full catastrophe, as Zorba the Greek described living. At the start, during the 80s, my focus was on untangling misguided beliefs about food. Along with most women who struggled with their weight, I believed that if I could resolve what seemed to be the source of my self-hatred, I would be thin, happy, free. It made so much sense. Take away the source of the pain, and the pain will go away, leaving a bright spirit in its place. As I lost weight, I quickly understood that issues with food were cover-ups. Yes, they needed to be addressed on the physical level, otherwise, they could turn into more serious illnesses. And yes, most of us needed to learn what our bodies longed for and needed because we'd been brainwashed into craving junk. But the genesis of compulsive eating was not physical. And unless its source was addressed, a range of equally painful behaviors would emerge. When my misery with food ended and didn't change anything except the size of my thighs, I kept trying to fix other broken parts of myself by immersing myself in therapy, intensive meditation retreats, and rigorous spiritual practices. Now I think of these last 30 years as similar to the wandering period in the Buddha's life, minus a few essentials like his willingness to sleep on nails, and eat one measly grain of rice a day. Furthermore, it took him 29 years less than me to catch on to the truth. In my own case, it was only recently that I was willing to relinquish the Me Project and stop trying to fix what had never been broken. I'd tried versions of not fixing myself before, but always with the secret hope that not fixing myself would fix me. This time, I wanted only one thing, to be at home in my mind and life as I knew it. I used the same practices I'd used to end my suffering with food. If being vigilant about stopping the harshness with which I treated myself had unraveled the most obsessive behavior pattern of my life, if allowing my full range of feelings without acting on them had dismantled my suffering with food, why wouldn't it dismantle what caused it? The ongoing, low-level discontent of what it felt like to be me. And finally, if being resolute about feeding myself with awareness and a large dose of kindness changed how I ate, why wouldn't it change how I lived? What if, as I once did and still do with food, I could live as if nothing was broken, nothing was missing, while nonetheless questioning the constellation of beliefs that led to anxiety, isolation, and self-hatred? What if I believed what Zen teacher Shunryu Suzuki said, that we are all perfect and that we need some improvement? Or as they say in Texas, God loves you exactly the way you are, and she loves you too much to let you stay like this. This Messy, Magnificent Life is about the path I followed and the obstacles I encountered along the way. It also challenges the conviction that everyday ease and freedom, no matter what the external situation, are reserved for the very few. That is, not for poor, doomed, little match girl, moi. The book starts where women, food, and God ended, around the table, because the way we eat is always a primary gateway to the mind that creates the suffering about it. My ongoing work with retreat students, their stories, and their breathtaking changes continues to provide a groundwork for not only the work with food, but also with an assortment of everyday doorways like illness, anxiety, hatred, misogyny, intimate relationships, and the guy paying with change in the express line. This messy, magnificent life chronicles the shift from feeling as if we are secretly defective, helpless, and too often walking on the barbed wire of our thoughts, to waking up with the ever-present, always sublime freedom from our incessantly restless minds right in the middle of ordinary life. Freedom from mental suffering is not a mystery, but a willingness to examine what keeps us from directly experiencing the deep blue peace and quiet joy that are always accessible and forever unaffected by the passing show. If the drama and chaos in the outside world are expressions of the minds that create them, then naming and questioning the way we live in these minds and on this earth is the only way that true change can happen. And so we begin. Part 1. Around the Table. Chapter 1. Mana. I am making a cup of tea in my favorite purple-flowered mug when I smell smoke. I look through the windows behind me and see plumes of smoke through the trees. I call the fire department, and they tell me there's a fire down the road, that it's not contained, and that we might have to evacuate our home. They'll let me know. My husband Matt is away. He never seems to be around during the panoply of biblical California disasters, earthquakes, fires, mudslides. So I will have to deal with this myself. My heart races. I feel panicked. But then I think, this will be fine. Sometimes bad is good. I remember a haiku by Zen master Masahid that I read just yesterday. Barns burnt down. Now I can see the moon. Since I have the luxury of time, I walk around the house looking at the things we've accumulated. My mother's antique Bombay chest, doors from Bali, a cabinet from Japan. The photographs of Matt and me at our wedding, of my mother and me at my twin nephew's bar mitzvahs last year. I put 5 framed pictures and 3 photo albums in a pile near the front door. I walk into my closet and I look around, a bit dazed. All these clothes. The only time my father hinted that he knew he was dying was a few weeks after he was diagnosed with stage 4 lymphoma, when we were walking past his closet. He said, "My clothes. What's going to happen to all my clothes?" As if they had lives of their own and would miss his legs, his arms, his wrists, or had meaning beyond his insatiable hunger for things and his inability to understand the meaning of enough. I look blankly at my shoes, my sweaters, my pants. If our house burns down and I am left with only the clothing I take now, what would I want? What can't I live without? I finger an embroidered jacket, think about throwing it in my car, but then I realize I haven't worn it in a year, and although it was once my favorite piece of clothing, it isn't now. I leave it hanging next to the black wool jacket with the short sleeves and the distressed gray corduroy jacket. I call my neighbor Susan, whose husband is a volunteer firefighter, to find out if she knows anything more about the fire. "What fire?" she asks, voice rising, and then Susan begins to scream. I'm in a wheelchair. I'm alone. I've just had back surgery. I can't move. I find myself thinking of the movie, Sorry, Wrong Number, when the wheelchair-bound Barbara Stanwyck overhears a plan to commit a murder that turns out to be her own. But I keep this thought to myself. I tell Susan I'll pick her up if we need to evacuate. I move slowly, as if underwater. I put jewelry in a backpack, my wedding ring, my father's Masonic ring that he wore until the day he died, my grandmother's earrings, my mother's enameled snake bracelet, my father's first watch. I zip up the backpack, walk out to the car, and put the bag in the trunk. I can't decide if I am numb or if I am enlightened, because I've taken nothing besides my purse, a computer, the stuffed toy pencil my first editor left me when she died, medicine, some underwear, the photograph albums, my favorite sweatshirt, our house insurance policy, our dog. I call the sheriff's office. They tell me they're going door to door and asking people to evacuate. It's not yet mandatory for our particular road, but soon may be. I decide to preempt the evacuation order, take the dog, call and pick up Susan, and leave, grateful that the flames I saw haven't cut off my escape down our one-lane road. At least I am alive. I dial Matt's number from the car and remember the call I placed to him on a Russian icebreaker in Antarctica a few years ago. Hi, honey. No one died, but Bernie Madoff's been arrested, and we've lost every cent of our money. As I drive, I keep thinking about my jackets, my father, our stuff, about what enough actually is. Then for some reason, I remember my college friend Linda. It was my senior year, and I was a dinner guest at Linda's mother's house. Linda and I were binging buddies. She was the one who shared a gallon of Breyer's vanilla fudge twirl ice cream with me and mined for the chocolate veins with her fingers. The one who, when making a batch of Toll House chocolate chip cookies, used the entire recipe to bake two huge cookies. That way, she told me, we only eat one cookie apiece. At her mother's house, Linda was sitting at the head of the table, scooping out ice cream into delicate porcelain bowls with violets and geraniums painted on their lips. Each one was passed around the table until everyone but me had their dessert. I looked at Linda and said, "This one's for me." She nodded her head. "I get it," she said, and proceeded to pile so much ice cream in the bowl that it began to drip down the red dahlias painted on the side of the bowl. The fact that I was already full from the dinner of fried oysters and gumbo didn't factor into my desire for that ice cream, not for one second. My motto was that if some was good, more had to be better. I was haunted by a wild hunger for something I couldn't name. And while food didn't fill it, having more of what I didn't want was better than having nothing at all. The word mana comes from the Hebrew word ma, which means what or what is it. In Exodus, the Torah says, in the morning there was a fall of dew about the camp. When the fall of dew lifted, there over the surface of the wilderness lay a fine and flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And a few verses later, and so the house of Israel named it manna. Each day when they awoke and greeted the day, they would say, "What is it?" For every day this manna was new, fresh, different from the day before. And no matter how much manna each person gathered, it was always exactly what that person needed. And although it tasted different to each person, it left each one satisfied and nourished. They couldn't store manna, hang it in their closets, or put it in their refrigerator, like leftover pizza. They couldn't buy it, barter it, or use it against each other. There was only enough manna for that day. and no one had more than anyone else. But somehow, Mana miraculously appeared each morning for 40 years of wandering in the desert. Man, oh man, from that perspective, refrigeration and closets sure mess things up. Because now we're wandering in the desert again, but this time it's the wilderness of too much, of feeling perpetually discontent and hungry for more, even when our bellies and our houses are stuffed. Halfway into an eating meditation at a retreat, a time when most people are no longer hungry, I asked people to put down their forks, take a breath, and stop eating. Jesus, I hear someone mutter, just when I was getting going. I look around the room. Donna's fork is in the air, ready for the next bite. Her mouth is still filled with food. After she swallows the current bite, she says, "I am hesitant to mention this, but I am really full, like a 12 on a scale of 1 to 10. But I don't want to stop, period, and you can't make me." I tell Donna she's right. I can't make her stop. And in any case, force, cajoling, and exerting willpower have all proved incredibly ineffective where compulsive eating is concerned. But, I tell her, I am nonetheless curious about two things: who she is taking me to be at the moment, and what she hopes that continuing to eat will give her. "My mother," she answers almost before I finish speaking. "You are definitely my mother. She put me on a diet when I was 2, and I've been on one ever since. And the answer to your second question is more, just more. If I put the fork down, if I stop eating, I feel deprived. I'm not sure if I'm feeling sad or lost or empty when the food is all gone, but I'm sure I want more." We don't know what we're feeding, but we know we want more. We're not sure what the sadness is about or why we feel inconsolable, but we're sure the solution is to take more, have more, eat more, as if the answer to everything that makes us uncomfortable is more, as if it's a choice between having more of what we don't want or nothing at all. A beloved spiritual teacher once told me that I kept protecting myself from losses that had already happened. I kept dragging the past into the present and carried it into the future. The deprivation of childhood, the scarcity of tenderness and of belonging, and my attempts to rectify them kept repeating themselves because that's all I knew. I had no language for sufficiency, no way to see it, no way to recognize what was actually in front of me. If a pickpocket stood before Jesus, another teacher said, all he would see is pockets. We see what we believe. When we look at the world with hungry eyes, we only see lack. Everything, people, meals, situations, looks like food we are desperate for. But the second we name what we are doing, the second we pay attention to it, we are no longer merged with it. We are no longer wandering in the desert or hoarding bowls of ice cream or starving for love. We are the awareness that notices that we are wandering in the desert, hoarding ice cream, starving for love. Attention is everything. Without it, all else is a temporary fix, and no long-lasting change is possible. Most of us already know this. We've tried hundreds of quick fixes, diets, affirmations, workshops that promise abundance, instant changes. Sometimes I ask a group of people how many of them have been on a diet. They all raise their hands. Then I ask how many people lost weight on that diet. All hands are raised again. Then, how many people gained weight on said diet? Again, everyone. Finally, the last question. How many people believe that another diet is the answer now? Everyone. We don't want to know what we already know. This is the part about having enough that has nothing to do with food. And this is the harder part, because we live in a culture that worships more. We are so brainwashed into believing that more is better, that we no longer question what it costs or whether it adds anything to our lives. We keep believing that there is an elusive tipping point when more will finally become enough. But no matter how thin we get or how much money we make, that point doesn't get any closer. And in the meantime, we spend our days riding the roller coaster of dissatisfaction, discontent, and disease. Or as one of my students said, I would die to be as thin as I was 5 years ago, when I would have died to have been thinner. Until a disaster comes along, like being given a terminal diagnosis or evacuating your house because there's a fire down the road. Then suddenly the urgency of what is happening breaks the trance of more. And after the panic subsides, we find ourselves right smack in the middle of the fragile, unrepeatable, never-ending now, which, it turns out, is the only place from where we can ever know what enough is. When my husband Matt and I lost almost every cent of our money in 2008, I was terrified, then I was ashamed, and then I panicked. As I wrote in Lost and Found, upon hearing my financial news, my teacher Jean said that nothing of value was lost. To which I replied, now is not the time to be spiritual. But I soon realized that just as I'd had a choice with food to suffer or not, I had a choice at that moment as well. I could keep panicking and focus on the fact that Matt and I had just lost 30 years of life savings and didn't have enough money to get through the next month, or I could realize, as the Zen teacher John Tarrant puts it, that the sun still shines, and you can still drink your coffee, and the birds still call in the morning, and you can find out that what you came to this planet for is not necessarily your apartment. In the end, I did both. But each time I descended into the hell realms of shame, I knew I would feel worse. And each time I made a choice to bring my attention back to the fact that I could still breathe, walk, and drink tea from my favorite purple mug, I felt lighter and happier than I'd been in a long time, even before we'd lost all our money. That seemed magical to me, but then I realized that before we lost our money, I was entranced by lack and the worry of not enough. And after losing our money, I kept choosing to focus on this breath, this step, because when I listened to my thoughts and focused on all we'd lost and on what we were going to do and how dumb we'd been to put all our money in one place, I felt as if I was going insane. The difference wasn't the money, since I felt we didn't have enough when we did and that we did have enough when we'd lost everything. The difference was where I chose to place my attention, and that I became fierce about not descending into the nightmare of my thoughts. Having enough came down to moment-to-moment choices of attention. A woman once asked a spiritual teacher why she could remain so uninterested in her thoughts and therefore remain present during a retreat, but when she got home and started washing the dishes, her mind wandered into the past and future. He responded that, at a retreat, you think what you're doing is important, but once you get home, you forget what you love more than your thoughts. In biblical moments, when there's a threat of a fire, or you lose your money, or you get a life-threatening diagnosis, the urgency forces you back into the present moment, and you suddenly realize how much you've been missing. You see the extraordinary in the ordinary. You pay attention to what has been here all along. The purple teacup, the trill of the whippoorwill outside your window, the sensation of your feet touching the floor in the middle of the night. You look, as the poet Mary Oliver says, on the deeper level, from the heavenly visibles to the heavenly invisibles. Later in the afternoon, on the day that Susan and I evacuated our homes, we were notified that the fire was contained. After helping her back into her house, I walked back into mine with the dog, photograph album, sweatshirt, computer, and jewelry. The awe at having a home, and for all the things, heat, roof, walls, showers, refrigerators, food, I take for granted, burned through my usual trance of managing one damn thing after another, as Churchill described history. For that evening and the many weeks that followed, I was awash in thank you, thank you, thank you for being alive, for being given another day with a roof over my head, for having love, sky, breath. My teacher Jean once said, "You do very well in catastrophes, Janine. You notice what's important, the fact that you're alive, breathing, sensing, taking in what's around you becomes primary. But the challenge is doing that on any old day, every day. You have to want this more than you want anything. You have to keep paying attention to the effulgence of every day." It's as if we slide back and forth between the desire for more, love, earrings, experiences, and fear that we will lose what we already have. In the movement from one pole to the other, we are always whirling in the trance of deficiency, in which we equate being alone with loneliness, restraint with deprivation, being silent with being empty, or at least I do. I get seduced by the promise of adding yet another ornament to the tree of myself, and forget to pay attention to the heavenly invisibles. And then I remember, and then I forget, and remember again. Chapter 2, The Last Bite. I am sitting at the kitchen table enraptured with a bowl of tomato soup. Not just any tomato soup. Mine has crushed tomatoes, coconut milk, sea salt, parsley, a dash of coconut oil, and honey. If you try it at home, blend to a thick consistency, add some thyme, pepper, and cloves. I look down at the bowl. A nip, not even a spoonful, is left. Although I'm no longer hungry, I still want more. Not of the tomato soup, but of rapture. I am like my retreat student Uma, who said, "I feel bereft when I'm full, because I can't think of one thing, not one, that is better than what's in my mouth. And so I keep eating to avoid the ending of goodness." And therein lies the problem, not just with food, but with all things temporal. Every meal disappears, every vacation ends. Dogs and cats, not to mention a raft of people we love, die before we do, and we are old, 10 minutes after we are rosy-cheeked, dewy-faced children. Bummer. I look back down at my might-as-well-be-empty bowl. I think again of my students and their reluctance, which is now my reluctance, to stop eating. Putting the spoon down feels like falling into the crack between worlds, like the ending of every relationship I didn't want to end, like being cut loose from the mothership. I went to a friend's memorial service the other day. When his wife of 42 years spoke, she said, "He was here and now he's not. I just can't believe a person could disappear like this." Later she told me that she'd gained 10 pounds since he died. "Chocolate ice cream helps," she said. "Eating gives me something to do, and it gives me something to feel besides grief. I walk around feeling very full, empty, but also full." As I listened to her, I realized that every time we stop eating when our bodies have had enough, we face a little death. We face emptiness, zip, even for a second. Which is, of course, why people find binging, i.e. not stopping, so helpful, albeit excruciating. Binging, constantly eating beyond enough, is a way to not have to face that what we love ends. Today at least I put the spoon down and decide not to take a second helping. I sit at the table listening to the silence, the space between eating and not eating, between one breath and another. And in the quiet, which is another name for emptiness, I hear the sound of the wind in the live oak trees. I look up from the table and see the sun illuminating a square patch of kitchen floor. The background birdsong suddenly becomes foreground, and I realize once again that jewels are scattered everywhere, not just at the table. And only when I stop eating do I hear or see or know them. Chapter 3. Lasting Weight Loss. Two women I know have each had two Lap-Band gastric sleeve procedures. Not one, but two operations in which they volunteered to have their bodies cut open and risk dying from surgical mistakes. All four of the operations did exactly what they were supposed to do, and the women did indeed lose weight. But each time, they discovered creative ways to commit sabotage. They ate small amounts all day long. They ate until they felt as if they would burst. And 6 months later, the weight started coming back. The million-dollar answer to the question of why weight loss is so difficult to maintain is that along with the exaltation of being thin come less positive feelings. The lightness that accompanies an unencumbered body feels vulnerable. And if we've used our weight in any way, even unconsciously, to keep us safe, the joy of weight loss can be overlaid by a wash of terror. In my experience, one of the unspoken reasons why many people don't maintain their weight loss is that they don't want to be thinner more than they want to stay protected or hidden. In my 20s, a few days from attempting suicide, I realized that I'd been speaking to myself in a language, eating uncontrollably, that I hadn't bothered to learn or understand. I decided, and this was the most radical and decidedly counterintuitive part, that I would trust the longing at the root of the compulsion rather than believing I was a self-destructive maniac. And once I took that leap and began trusting myself with food, my friends looked at me in horror when I ate whatever I wanted those first few weeks. Everything changed. The ongoing question was no longer what I could do to control my insanity, but what the eating could teach me. I saw almost immediately that every time I lost weight, I flung myself at unavailable men and then got consumed by the drama of convincing someone who didn't and would never want me to want me, which being an impossible task, took up quite a lot of time. I felt so unattractive at 80 pounds over my natural weight that flinging my body hither and thither was out of the question. And so I joined a writing class and started to write daily, something I'd longed to do since fifth grade, and quickly understood that if I got involved with yet another unavailable man, my creativity would focus on inventing interesting ways to capture he who had no interest in me. I decided to pour that creative energy into writing instead. When I figured out that I could do for myself what eating had been unconsciously doing, I realized I'd been attempting to get through to myself with food, and vanilla fudge ice cream lost its allure. Even when I gained weight those first few weeks, because I didn't quite believe I wasn't going to punish myself with food again, so I figured I might as well eat as much as I could before the axe fell, I never went back to dieting or believing I was out of control. When we don't believe or understand that weight serves a crucial purpose, We feel as if having a thin body is like being shot into the open sky without a spacesuit. We are supposed to know how to breathe without a mask, move in a body that is no longer weighted down, relate to people without layers of padding. And we're supposed to feel thrilled about the whole process, even when the pounds we shed served us in oh so many ways. If you ask a group of people who want to lose weight whether they'd find being thinner threatening, you would hear a unanimous no. But you would be asking adults, and that which wants to stay hidden is young. The proof is not in what people say they want, but in what they do. Not in their wishes, but in their actions, which consistently lead to the spectacularly dismal results of maintaining weight loss. And while it is the adult who decides to limit her food, or eat the paleo diet, or substitute good fats for trans fats, it is the ghost children, the ones that hid in the closet when our parents were fighting, or whose breasts our uncles fondled, or whose mother died when we were 10, who sabotage the results. If even just a part of us is constellated around a painful story from the past, if we haven't named or allowed the feelings that accompany that story their due, then losing weight is like telling a small child that everything on which her survival depends has been ripped away. Not exactly a recipe for success. The heart of any addiction, drugs, alcohol, sex, money, food, is the avoidance of pain coupled with the unwillingness to acknowledge that both the behavior and its consequences serve us even as they destroy our lives. They keep us distracted from the original pain by creating another, possibly life-threatening situation. When we have to focus our attention on not driving while drunk or having an operation to limit the food we eat so that we can walk, we have little time or interest in naming and meeting feelings we've been exiling for 30 or 40 years. Losing weight may indeed bring up fear of being overwhelmed by the very feelings you've used food to exile, but so what? Fear isn't a monster, it's a feeling. And like any feeling, it passes. Fear can be felt, held, dissolved by naming it, feeling its location in our bodies. Instead of avoiding fear, we can do what is counterintuitive. Welcome it and notice that the part that allows the fear is much bigger than the fear itself. Maintaining weight loss isn't about what we eat, not really. It comes back to what we want from our brief time here on Earth. It's about making a commitment to act in ways that match that desire, including our relationships to people, the work we do, the food we eat, and not giving ourselves the wiggle room of thinking we can go on a diet to lose weight and then pay attention to what drives us to food. Alas, it doesn't work like that. How we get there is who we will be when we arrive there. If we deprive and shame ourselves with food or any other area of our lives, we will be deprived, ashamed beings who might also be thin for 5 minutes. Make no mistake about people who leap from burning windows, David Foster Wallace wrote. Their terror of falling from a great height is still just as great as it would be for you and me. The variable here is the other terror, the fire's flames. When the flames get close enough, falling to death becomes the slightly less terrible of two terrors. Choosing to keep struggling with food, whether it's our way up or down the scale, is a choice to stay in the burning building of suffering while telling ourselves we can't help it. The other choice is to jump from the burning building and discover, according to Choigam Trumpa, that you're falling through the air. Nothing to hang on to, no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. Chapter 4, Heavenly Bodies. After breaking my back in an accident several years ago, it occurred to me that I hadn't realized I had a back. Not really. Yes, I knew the word for back. I knew my back was behind my front. I knew what a vertebra was from photos in freshman biology. I knew that when I did Pilates twice a week, it sometimes hurt back there. But as a longtime runner, dancer, and mountain hiker, I'd always treated my body like a machine I could push to its limits, like a piece of clay I could sculpt to my image of it. I thought of my body as a collection of limbs and organs that happened to be connected to the person I took myself to be. It was like owning a 3-story house and living in the attic for 64 years. In her book, M-Train, Patti Smith asks, how is it that we never completely comprehend our love for someone until they're gone? A version of the same question might be asked for backs that support us, legs that carry us, arms that pick up our children, and even for having bodies at all. In my own case, it took breaking my back to recognize the good fortune of having one. Until the broken vertebrae and the radical pain that ensued, I was both mystified and bored by what I'd heard other people call living in the body. It felt uninteresting and irrelevant. It also felt unnecessary, since everything I wanted to do, move, work, touch, eat, sleep, talk, could and did happen without occupying the lower floors. As usual, it took a crisis to wake me up, this time to the difference between having a body and living in it. The vertebral mishap made it clear that I'd been treating my body with unconscious resentment. Really, I think? I have to interrupt when I am doing and work out with weights 3 times weekly to keep my bones strong? I have to stand up every 20 minutes when I'm riding because, quote, sitting is the new smoking? And I have to practice Kegel exercises called closing the garage door and snapping the turtle shut so that I don't end up wearing Depends? It didn't stop there. There was also the day-to-day maintenance of flossing, water picking, deep skin cleansing, and food preparation, just to wake up the next morning and do it over again. To that full-time job, add the hours of reading about and ordering the array of sunscreens that don't give you cancer, hair thickeners that don't make you look as if you stuck your finger in an electric socket, and toe separators for bunions. When I bring up the subject of embodiment at my retreats, the response is equally unenthusiastic. For God's sake, my students say, now I have to pay attention to my body? My children need to be picked up from school. I have a business to run, a paper to write. Can't you just tell me what, when, and how much to eat so that I can do it for a few weeks and then rebel against being told what, when, and how much to eat? No one ever told me that living in my body was part of the deal here, and I don't have time to learn something new. Yes, I say, I understand, after which I often quote James Joyce. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. A wave of head nodding ensues, after which someone murmurs, but the real problem is that my mother made me go on a diet when I was 10. And we're back in the attic again, watching childhood reruns. In the movie The Story of Stuff, the narrator says there is no such thing as a way when we throw something away. It's all connected. The plastic bag in your hand, the shirt you just bought, the poisoning of the oceans. There is no away, I kept saying to myself in those first post-fracture months. Because although I did not believe that I was to blame for breaking my back, I did see that for many years, I'd treated my body as a dumpster in which I could throw any food my mind wanted without consequences, as if the sheer physicality of this body and the intangibility of my mind, aka the real me, were unrelated. I was kinder to my jade plant than to my body. I treated my cell phone with more reverence than I treated my body. And yet, while living in our bodies rather than a short distance from them would help us be alert and awake in our daily lives, it is also true that despite the wishes of Walt Disney, who lies frozen in a crypt, waiting to be sprung back to life when we discover the secret to immortality, bodies are not meant to last forever. Even if we spend 90 years treating these bodies magnificently, they will wear out and die. Or they will be hit by a truck, a stray bullet, or a renegade virus and die young. There is also the possibility that, like an increasing number of tourists, we will die by selfie while standing, say, on the top of Machu Picchu and falling to the bottom. And there it is, the D word. Life is like stepping onto a boat which is about to sail out to sea and sink, writes Zen teacher Shunryu Suzuki. It is impossible to talk about bodies without also talking about death, because whether we work out frantically or vacate the floors below the attic, bodies die. But as temporary, fragile, and vulnerable as our bodies are, they are the most direct portals to the only forever there is. In the last few weeks of my father's life, days were measured in breaths, not minutes. Even the division of mornings sliding into afternoons, rolling into evenings disappeared. Only this sip of water, these moistened lips, this exact moment mattered. Since I'd been 4 years old, I dreaded the death of my father, convinced that when he died, I would die. But now I attended to only this breath, this sip of water. Although I had an extraordinary and complicated relationship with my father, I was closer to him when he was dying than when he was healthy. And it wasn't because he couldn't talk back to me, well, maybe just a little, or comment on the Bach sonatas I played at his bedside. It was because death loomed so large that my mind could do nothing but give up its relentless drone and notice that nothing was missing. Nothing was wrong. Every time I dropped the cloth into the water, lifted it to his mouth, touched his lips, eons converged, melted, expanded. Universes were born, died, and were born again in the time it took to change his t-shirt. Every now was an eternity. If I'd been a more skillful meditator, I would have probably discovered the same thing when sitting on a cushion. But I'm not, and I didn't. After he took his last breath, I closed my father's eyes, held his hand, and watched his face. During the next few hours, I kept looking for him and what remained. His familiar smell, baby smooth hands, knobby nose, but he was gone. I don't know where he went, but it was as if he dropped his body like one of his Gucci loafers. Since his arms and legs were there, but he wasn't, I had the thought that, as the Indian sage Nisargadatta says, we are not in our bodies. Our bodies are in us. Besides sitting with a dying person, the best way I know to be in daily contact with what never dies is to be awake now, to use the senses as a portal to what lies beyond them. Because the body sensations are immediate, noticing them cuts through the babble of the mind that is always lurching from the past to the future, nattering on about details, hopes, and desires. On the horizontal level of day-to-day maintenance, Digital devices, Kegel exercises, and toe separators keep this so-called life going. But they are not life itself, just as clouds are not the sky. Saint Francis of Assisi said, "What we are looking for is what is looking." When we only pay attention to the ever-changing parade of thoughts, we miss what is looking. But when we actively notice and occupy the body we already have, we begin noticing what Eckhart Tolle calls the inner body, that blazing, animated life force that allows the rest to be visible. The part of us that has never, not for a second, gone away, and that eventually drops this body like a tight shoe. Here's my suggestion. Spend 5 minutes a day. Everyone has 5 minutes. In segments of a minute apiece, noticing where you are. Just that much. You didn't float to your desk. You didn't get beamed from your bedroom to your kitchen. Your foot touches the floor. Step, step, step on your way. You pass other objects. You hear a panoply of hums, noises, clatter. Did you see what you were looking at? Listen to what you were hearing? Are you here? Or are you rummaging around in the attic of your mind? A breath when you are noticing it takes eons to fill your chest and leave it. When you become aware of the sound of the wind, the blare of a horn, the click of a computer key, you can't help being aware of the life force that expresses itself through this fragile body. And while immortality is not an option, I'm talking to you, Walt, when you fully drop into what you see or feel in your body, time falls away because it has no relevance. You cannot help but open to what gives it radiance, eternity itself, 4.6 billion years of stardust. And we have it because we are it. Chapter 5. If I Were Gloria Steinem. My friend Dave, quoting from multiple sources, once told me that a friend is someone you call when you need to move. A good friend is someone you call when you need to move a body. Isabel is the body-moving kind of friend. Recently, though, she has become a conspiracy theorist. She's convinced that there is a cabal, a congregation of evil lizard people called the Draco, whose intent is to control and ultimately destroy humanity. According to her, the attacks of September 11th were orchestrated by the cabal. So were the Paris attacks and ISIS itself. Also Vanity Fair, Vogue, most movie stars, politicians, and all billionaires are part of or controlled by the cabal. Isabel maintains that for selling your soul, the cabal grants you fame, success, and gushes of money, after which you are forever owned by them. She says, it's like the Matrix, but in real life. We are puppets of the cabal. We think we are free, but we're being hypnotized and manipulated by the ones in power. How do I know I'm not part of the cabal? I ask her. Maybe they got to me in my sleep. You're not important enough, she says. But despite all the websites Isabel cites, the so-called evidence she reels off, I don't believe in the cabal or an objective evil. I do believe there are and have always been confused, misguided people who commit insane acts. Although it seems as if there is an insane world out there, it makes no sense to me that there is an out there that isn't also in here. In different circumstances, with no money, no food, and the promise of a heavenly afterlife, I too would be capable of violence. It already doesn't take much for a well-fed, velvet-clothed me to believe that those who cross me, the aggressive driver on the freeway, the basketball analyst Charles Barkley when he disses Steph Curry, Anyone who disagrees with me are my enemies and must be vanquished. The day after my conversation with Isabel, I heard Gloria Steinem interviewed on NPR's program, Fresh Air, about her book, My Life on the Road, and it got me thinking about the cabal again. Gloria said that one of the ways the patriarchy controls women is by controlling their reproductive rights and therefore their bodies. She referred to a 1970s panel on abortion. It was comprised of 10 men and one nun. You can't make these things up, she said. Then she was asked about today's most pressing women's issues, and she mentioned domestic violence, female genital mutilation, rape, and sex trafficking. I kept waiting for her to mention women and weight, but she didn't. Because it's almost always defined as a mundane matter of willpower or sloth, food gets ignored as a political issue. When Gloria was asked about her relationship with food, she mentioned her father, who weighed 300 pounds and believed that anything could be cured by a malted and a movie. He was sort of right about that, she said laughingly, and added that she herself still had a weakness for sweets. That was the point at which I wanted to say, "Wait, Gloria, you're missing something. I don't know of a single woman, and I've been privileged to be allowed entry into the inner lives of hundreds of thousands of them, who hasn't struggled with the size of her body. And when a woman's energy is tied up in judging her body, it ties up her power as well." Might this be another way the patriarchy controls women's bodies? By hypnotizing us into believing we must be thin in order to have value or authority? If I wanted to silence half the population of the world, the one most likely to oppose war and guns, I can't think of a better way to do it. Expecting a woman to stand up for what she knows while convincing her that she must first be thin is like binding a Chinese woman's feet and asking her to run a marathon. We don't need a cabal to enthrall or manipulate or silence us. We've done it ourselves with limitless assistance of the patriarchy by channeling most of our life's energy into having thinner thighs. This doesn't mean we should join the fat acceptance movement or only blame men for trying to control our bodies. Even if this whole brouhaha with women, food, and weight is the patriarchy's way to silence us by keeping us focused on impossible goals. 50 women in the world look like supermodels, 3.5 billion don't and never will. We'd still have to do the same thing. Stop allowing it. When we realize we've had duct tape over our mouths for decades, there is only one thing to do. Tear it off. Our power is not in blaming or shaming, but in waking up from the collective trance in which we've been living. We use the same arms we've been told are too fat, and we uncover the same mouths we've been told are too loud, and then we start telling the truth about what we already know, but don't want to know we know. There are many ways of truth-telling, but the best way I know is to ask questions and be relentlessly honest in answering them. Is it true that when I lose weight, I will have the body and therefore the life I want? Have I ever lost weight? How many times? Aside from having a thinner body, did losing weight fix my relationships with friends, family, or colleagues? If it is such a cure-all, why did I gain it back? Answers like, because I lost my job, my spouse, my best friend, don't count. Answers like, yes, but next time it will be different, are excuses and probably lies. If there was a cabal, or if the patriarchy was entrancing women into silence about the destruction of the environment, the plethora of guns and mass shootings, and waging war as an answer to everything, the $60 billion weight loss industry would be proof that they were winning. The fact that we are frightened of our hungers and our strength would be proof. and the way our energy gets trapped in dieting over and over and over again would seal the deal. If your doctor